Well, good morning. The time is 1 minute after 10 on Wednesday, November 4th, and you are tuned to WPRB, Princeton, New Jersey. Community-supported independent radio at 103.3 FM or online around the world at www.wprb.com. Welcome to another edition of Classical Discoveries. I am your host for this program, Marvin Rosen, and will be with you today until 12 noon. I am being joined from now until 12 by American composer Jerome Kitsky, and hope you can stay with me until noon. I also want to thank Dave for offering to give me 1 hour of his show today. We go now to music by Jerome Kitsky, my guest.
Thank you.
Well, you were just listening to Breath and Bone, a composition by American composer Jerome Kitsky, who was born in 1955. You heard accordionist and vocalist Guy Klusevic, along with the composer Jerome Kitsky, who contributed more vocals, foot stomps, and whistling. Well, up until noon today, I am being joined live by Jerome Kitsky, who is celebrating his 60th birthday. In fact, we will be talking about a pair of concerts coming up in New York on November 13th and 14th. These concert part of Tribeca New Music will feature as a whole 12 works, including a world premiere, and we will talk much more about these concerts later on. For now, we welcome Jerome Kitsky, the one and only. Jerome, welcome, and thank you so much for coming.
Thanks, Marvin. It's really great to be here.
Yes, it's going to be a fun couple of hours here. For those of you who are unaware, Jerome Kitsky lives in New York City, but grew up along the southwestern shore of Lake Michigan in Milwaukee, where he was born in 1955. Since his first work in 1970, he has thought himself to be as much a storyteller as he is a composer. Some of the stories are about life's personal roads, like The Redness of Blood and Sunflower Sutra, which both express the composer's love for his blood family. Many, however, like Bach's Death Hollow and the Pahasapa Giveback, are about the roads that go looking for what it means to be an American late in the 20th century, especially as it relates to the connection between how we live on this land and the way we came to live on it. Kitsky's music celebrates American vitality in its purest forms. It thrives on the spirit of driving jazz, Plains Indian song, and Beat Generation poetry, where freedom and ritual converge. It is direct, dramatic, and visceral, and with an ear to the sacred ground. Mr. Kitsky composes for and performs with his group, the Mad Coyote. His music has been performed in North and South America, Europe, Asia, and Australia by such organizations as the Milwaukee Symphony, the New Juilliard Ensemble, Essential Music, Present Music, Earplay, and many others. It has been performed by such artists as Guy Klusevic, Margaret Leng Tan, Kathleen Supove, and many, many others. Well, now that I gave the big introduction to you, you've done so much in your life with your music, and I have to say, your style is really incredible.
Thank you.
It's very creative, very original, and it is has, like you say, your music is as much involved with storytelling as music, and we'll get to some of that a little later on. For now, though, let us talk just a bit about what we just heard, Breath and Bone, which was written for Guy Klusevic, a guest on this show a few years ago. Tell us about this work and anything you would like to share about regarding it.
Sure. In 1996, it was a commission from Guy Klusevic for a concert he was doing at Merkin Hall at the time, and he premiered the piece at Merkin Hall in, I believe, March of 1996. It is actually an elegy, however, written for one of my dear, great friends, the percussionist Gregory Sharnan, who died in 1995 at the age of 39. And it's not a typical elegy, pretty obviously, in that it doesn't have the stereotypical solemnity to it. It's really an elegy that's meant to highlight Gregory Charnin's great indomitable spirit in his life and how he was going, what he was going through as he was dying. So it's an elegy written for my great friend Gregory Charnin, and it was originally conceived for Guy to play it as a solo, doing all of the vocals and foot stomps and whistling that you just heard, which he did in the premiere. And then Guy and I recorded the piece in the late 90s, the recording you just heard, and he asked me to do it with him as a duo, which we've done many times live. And then later, Guy finally recorded it as in its original solo version a little bit later.
Well, we're going to talk later, as we discussed off camera, about some of the, I guess you could say, challenges performers will have with this music, because there are many of them. They're doing many different things. They're not just playing. We'll get more about that, into that a little bit later. Before, though, we listen to more music, share with us a bit, Jerome, about your early exposures to music and your musical training. Were your parents musical?
Not formally. My mother had a terrific alto voice, and she sang a little bit on radio when she was in the Army during World War II. My father claimed he had a tin ear, but it wasn't really true, because I would hear him singing, and he could carry a tune. There was music around the house, but not a lot. And then, of course, I was heavily into radio and rock and roll. And 1964, February 9th, the Beatles.
Oh, the Beatles.
That, like many millions of young people around the country, I got my attention.
And you were listening to the Ed Sullivan Show.
Oh, yeah.
Like everybody else, including myself.
Yes, and that was a great way to be involved with music as well, watching shows like that and hearing all the new groups that were coming around. And I was 9 years old when that happened, and it took me about a few years, and I pestered my parents into a Farfisa combo compact organ.
Oh, my God.
I wanted a Hammond B3, but that's all we could really come up with as a Farfisa, which I just sold that instrument, by the way, a couple of years ago. So it was a 48-year-old instrument.
Yeah.
So anyway, I got into music that way, and I, like many people around the country, young people, I formed a rock band with four or five friends, none of whom could play their instruments very well, but that didn't matter.
That didn't matter when you were young, right?
No. It was just this great spirit of trying to create something and be a part of the energy that was going on with rock and roll at the time, and that really got me going. Then, when I was 15 years old in high school, I had an English teacher, Mary Johnson, and we were reading John Steinbeck's The Pearl. And she said that she wanted to analyze the book in a different way by having some of the students write musical themes based on some of the human themes in the book. And she came to my desk and asked me to participate in this. And I said, well, Miss Johnson, I don't write music. What are you talking about? She knew I was in rock bands, and she knew I played French horn very badly in the high school orchestra and band. So I think she thought perhaps that, I could write music too. And I took it as a challenge, and I said, sure, I'll give it a shot. And lo and behold, I discovered I had some innate buried talent that I didn't know about, and that's 1970, so 45 years later, I'm still writing music.
Well, tell me about, or tell our audience more specifically, tell us about your music written in 1970.
They were little solo piano pieces, as I said, based on this John Steinbeck novella, the very first one was called Song of the Family. It's about 3 minutes long. It's very sweet in D major. And I still play these little pieces whenever I'm around a piano at artist colonies and what and such every day, just to keep myself grounded back into the place I came from. And I made a recording of these little works, and I handed them out to my family. And so it's a great touchstone for me, those pieces.
How about now studying later on?
Well, soon after those pieces, I got introduced in high school orchestras and bands to certain classical music. But I started to listen to Beethoven and Tchaikovsky and Brahms and Bach and then Stravinsky and Messiaen, people like that. And it tore the top of my head off just as vigorously as all the great rock and roll was doing at the time. So I became completely enamored with the idea of what it took to write these scores, to write scores and to write notated scores, and the fact that the score you wrote, every single thing that you put on paper was going to be interpreted by anywhere from 2 to 100 different people. And that just really intrigued me, and that's how I got into writing notated music.
Oh, wow. I just a little side note, I read that one of your, one of your many favorite pieces is one of mine, Messiaen's Tarongalila Symphony.
Oh, yeah. I remember the Milwaukee Symphony did a performance of it, and I was with a friend at the concert, and we were sitting there after the piece was over, and we could barely stand up. We were just so mesmerized by it. I think the New York Philharmonic's doing it this coming March.
It's a piece it's becoming. When I was a kid, it was kind of, you never heard. I remember there was the old Ozawa recording with Toronto, I believe. And I heard Ozawa conduct it when I was a college student in Carnegie Hall.
Wow.
And Messiaen was in the audience, and I remember going backstage and having him sign my music for me. I'll never forget mm-hmm. that, but that was one of the real memorable concerts in the early part of my life.
Yeah, like I said, the Milwaukee Symphony concert I went to is a strong memory for me. It was just so visceral and earthy and powerful and thematic and topical.
Yeah, I mean, wonderful orchestration, and we could talk about that for a long time. But let's keep on the topic, which is Jerome Kitsky. Let's listen now to another one of your works. We're going to listen to The Enemist Child. Tell us a bit about that and the scoring and who our performers are.
Sure. Believe it or not, in 1994, there were at least 2 different people making part of their musical living playing toy piano recitals, Margaret Langtan,
yes,
and Wendy Mae Chambers. And Wendy commissioned a piece from me to premiere in July of that year, and it was going to be for solo toy piano. And I loved the sound of the instrument, and I knew the John Cage work, the very famous John Cage piece, the suite.
The suite, sure.
And so I wrote this piece. It's a little over 5 minutes long. It's dedicated to Bix Carl Windbeal, who was born the same day the piece was finished. It's pretty much kind of a stomp on the earth as an acknowledgement for the beginning of life through the use of a toy piano, which... The toy pianos are very sturdy. They're designed to take whackings from little children with their fists and to get knocked over. Mm. And so I utilized my love for percussion in this piece as well, where the pianist is asked to drum on the piano and also do a lot of vocalizing. This recording we're going to hear is me playing the piece, but it's been played by maybe 6 or 7 people around the world, including Margaret and Wendy.
Well, we're going to listen to it now. We hear The Enemist Child, dating from 1994, by my guest, Jerome Kitsky.
Ila mala incha Hey, cha tiki ba tiki ba cha tiki ba tiki ba. Hey, hey, hey. Mala, oh,
you were just listening to The Animus Child by my guest, Jerome Kitsky, who was our performer on toy piano and also provided the vocals and the foot stomps. Right. Wow, that's quite a tour de force, especially for one person.
Takes some coordination.
Yeah, I was going to say, and we'll talk, as I said, more about that later. For now, though, let's go briefly, before we go into the concerts, let's go briefly about how being an American, I know that's a very general question, but how it's affected your music.
Wow. Well, I think in many ways it has, but primarily it has to do with the attention I started to pay to how America became the country it is vis-a-vis the relationships it had with the native nations
that,
of course, were here for millennia and millennia and millennia before us. As a child, I always felt something was amiss and askew in how I was taught in school about these issues. And as an adult, I began, in the mid-80s, I began to explore these issues more because I was planning to write a piece called Box Death Hollow that was a commemoration of the centennial of the Wounded Knee Massacre in the 1890. And so that part of being an American was very important to me, that I felt I could be a better one by understanding some of these stories and these issues a little more clearly than I had been given information for as a child. And if you go deeply into the story and you go actually talk to some Indian people and not just read books about it, it's an incredible story, but it's a terrible story. But it's also a very rich story. And for me, there was so much music that came out of those experiences. In fact, last night I got a phone call from Charlotte Black Elk on the Pine Ridge Reservation just to say hello and check in. And she's actually the dedicated my premiere
of the new piece
on the Friday night concert, November 13th, is called For Pate to Kahewe Ska. And that's Charlotte's Lakota name, which means white buffalo woman of different motion. So it's a dedication piece to her, or it's a sextet. And so I remember in my early days of writing pieces about these issues, I was questioned very severely by the Indian people I met, and understandably so. And some of them would say, yeah, you're doing your Wounded Knee piece, and then you're just going to forget about us, because they basically, that's what's happened to them most of the time. They get a little attention, and then they're marginalized.
And then things kind of go on, and then that's in the past. It's something else.
And I said to those people, I don't think so. And over the last 28 years, I've written probably a dozen pieces that revolve around these issues. And that's how, I think for me, that's how my being an American has affected my music, my desire to understand these stories more, as well as, of course, the great landscape of the country. And I've been all over this country, and I've stayed outside in all weathers in this country, and I've really participated in connecting myself to the American dirt and the country and the mountains and the rivers and streams. And the openness of the West, the beauty of the East, and the incredibly beauty of the middle part of the country and the Great Plains has really affected my thinking. I can't describe how that gets into my music, but I think it's there.
But the influence with the American is, this is wonderful, you know, because so much of this we just kind of do and we go on, you know, and this has become a major part of your life and your kind of like your purpose in a way, I guess, possibly.
I just want to tell stories like you alluded to in the introduction.
Yeah.
And some of those stories are about some very difficult things, and some of them are about very simple things like the birth of a child, or the terrible simplicity of the death of a loved one. Or just a piece to honor somebody. You know, people are very important to me. Nature is very important to me. But the idea of telling your own personal story as you live your life, that's what I'm interested
that's
in doing.
Very important. Wow, that's great. Well, let us go now to a pair of concerts coming up. Jerome, celebrating your magical 60th birthday.
The 60th birthday was actually in February, but, you know, in the 60th birthday, you kind of stretch it out.
Well, you celebrate the whole year.
Yes.
And enjoy it. That's what, and just enjoy it. Well, first of all, before we go into these concerts, well, tell us how these came into being.
My dear friend, the incredible bass clarinetist, composer Michael Lowenstern, who I've worked with now for over 20 years, he and I were having dinner one night in January of 2012, shortly after my father died, and I was pretty out of it with grief and just kind of enjoying his company and still in shock. And he just out of nowhere said, hey, you're going to turn 60 in a year and a half or a couple of years. And he said, we should do some concerts for that. And he said, concerts. I like the plural.
I like you like the plural.
Yeah. So originally he was talking about three, but I think two is just plenty. Anyway, so he had this idea, and I was, and like I said, I was numb with grief. And I said, oh, sure, great idea, Michael, and let's talk about it. So time passed, and about a year ago, he got in touch with me and said, okay, it's time to start planning and getting it together. So Michael Lowensterns had the idea, and then he had the idea also to pair up with the great Tribeca New Music organization and Preston Staley. And so we had meetings about it, and it takes a lot of effort, and lots of people are involved, and everybody did their part. And so the fruit of this labor will be coming up next week.
Next week. November 13th and 14th at 7 p.m., both concerts at the DeMenis Center for Classical Music, Mary Flogler, Carrie Hall. This is at 450 West 37th Street in New York, near 10th Avenue. And you can go to TribecaNewMusic.org. That's Tribeca, TribecaNewMusic.org. Well, tell us about the actual concerts, Jerome, themselves.
Sure. It's 12 compositions over two nights, going back as far as 1987 and up to current day. The oldest piece on the program is called The Big Gesture, and that's a trio for oboe, percussion, and bass clarinet. And the newest work is for Pate Tokahewe Ska, which is the work I just mentioned before, written for Charlotte Black Elk. That's a sextet for flutes, played by Margaret Lancaster, bassoon, played by Sarah Schoenbeck, bass clarinet, played by Michael Lowenstern, Hammond organ, played by Will Smith, percussion, played by Jay Johnson, and, cello, played by the great Dorothy Lawson from Ethel.
Oh, sure, sure. So these concerts look very, very exciting. And it's kind of, I guess you could say, like a anthology of your work, or is that how you would put it?
It's a very good cross-section of my thinking over the last almost 30 years. And some of the players go back. Barbara Mergen goes back to 1991. I started working with her, and I mentioned Mike Lowenstern already. And it's just most of these people I've worked with a lot. And then there are several people I've never worked with, so it's always nice to meet new people and play with new people. And the concert is a great cross-section of the kinds of works I mentioned earlier that are written about certain things, and there's several pieces that are very personal, like Sunflower Sutra, which is written for my sister Mary as she was dying in the late 90s, and then Breath and Bone is, like I said, for Greg Rishanin, and then you have very political works like the Pahasapa Give Back, and anti-war works like Mad Coyote Madly Sings, and Winter Count. And Winter Count is being done by the great Jennifer Marshall Evans, an actor, Barbara Mergen on percussion, and Ethel, the string quartet.
Now, if you can't answer my next question, I understand, okay? There's nothing tied to this one. Don't worry, Jerome, I'm not going to do that. I never do that. But I'm looking at this kind of like this cross-section of your music in terms of the years. I see a composition going back. What was the first one? 1987.
Yes.
Has your style and outlook towards writing changed, do you think, since then? And in what way or ways? How?
My outlook hasn't changed
because
it's just the way I've always felt. Yeah. I just want to tell a good tale as best I can, utilizing whatever tools I need at the given moment, sonic tools and whatnot. My style, I really have no idea.
You just write what you feel like writing, because you see so many different things going on in your music, or hear them, and that's actually, to be honest with you, that was how I thought you were going to answer. But I thought I would give it a shot just to, but the way you answered
Sorry.
It was, no, but the way you answered it was your answer.
Yeah.
because that's how you're writing. You're writing just to what comes out of your heart as you're doing it.
And I also, if I don't have anything to say, I'm not adverse to not doing the work when it's not there to do. And during those off times, during those hiatus from working, I believe I'm still actually working because I'm accumulating life experience and I'm bringing in more and more information and influences from
all that. Well, let's go now, Jerome, to a major work. Your composition, Haunted America, which was written as a response to 9/11, that day we will never forget.
Right.
Just share with us a bit about this composition and how it came about and about some of the background.
It was a commission by the terrific Milwaukee group Present Music in 2002. And Haunted America came about mostly because I was thinking about the response to 9/11, the initial response, the very almost at times jingoistic response. And I understood that to a certain degree, but I also was a little bit wary of it because I understand in all of human endeavors and all these things that happen to humanity, everybody has a role in bringing about these occurrences. And my piece, Haunted America, just wants to say, let's make sure we take a broadly scoped look at this and really think about who did this to us, but why they did it, and did we have any role in it? Now, I just think that's a normal way to think about anything that happens. Nothing is ever really very black and white. So the piece actually has a text that asks questions, hey, America, what haunts you? Do you know? That kind of question. And for me, it got connected back to how I feel that actually a lot of Americans, whether they know it or not, are haunted by their history vis-a-vis the Native American cultures that were so drastically affected by contact going over 500 years now. And I think we're haunted by that, too, by these unsaid and unspoken things and how certain people have been marginalized. And I do believe that if more attention is paid to these issues, that we also can, like I said, I feel I've become a better American by doing it. And it's best, I think, in any human situation to know the gritty, nitty-gritty, dirty aspects of it, as well as the beautiful and uplifting aspects. The line between the two is often very fine, and Haunted America is about that to a certain degree as well.
Well, we're going to hear it now, and this is Present Music performing on an Innova compact disc. We listen now to Haunted America by my guest, Jerome Kitsky.
Hey, America. What? Haunts. Ooh, 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 ooh
Do you know? Hey, America. When will we end the human war? Thank you. Hey, America. We must. just.
Music by my guest, Jerome Kitsky. That was his composition, Haunted America. It was performed by members of Present Music. The work was written as a response to 9/11. Well, good morning. It is 10:58 on Wednesday, November 4th, and you are tuned to WPRB, Princeton, New Jersey, community-supported independent radio at 103.3 FM, or online around the world at www.wprb.com. Welcome to an extended edition of Classical Discoveries. I am your host for this program, Marvin Rosen, and we'll be with you today for another hour. We are being joined until 12 noon today by American composer Jerome Kitsky, and hope you are enjoying today's program. I also want to take this opportunity to thank Dave for actually offering to give me 1 hour of his show today. Thank you so much, Dave. You will be back at 12 noon. Again, thank you so much. Well, Jerome, welcome back. Great to have you here.
Thanks, Marvin.
And we're having a great amount of fun talking on the air and even off the air as well. It's been great to meet you and visit with you here at WPRB. You said you had one more thing you wanted to mention.
Yeah, I wanted to add about the piece Haunted America that there's a point in it where I use an Allen Ginsberg quote from his poem, The Fall of America, where he says, "When will we end the human war?" And I suggest that it might be very hard to do that given human nature, but that ultimately at the very end, when all is said and done, the only thing we can really do in the aftermath of such terrible tragedy is to just continue to live your life.
Yeah, that's true. So true. There are always problems and issues.